Hello and welcome to the Forbes India Cover Story podcast series in association with theindicars.com. My name is Abhishek, and this cover package is a deep tech special. This explores some fascinating startups across the board, and joining me on the call is Forbes India's Harichandan Arakali, who's written a bunch of stories about 10 startups, 6 VC profiles, an overview letter, and a few columns that he's corresponded and anchored. So hi, Hari. A lot of work has gone into this one.
Hi, Abhishek. Yeah, it was fun, although physically it was a bit taxing, but it was really fun putting this one together.
So then I'm going to disappoint you with a very basic question for a guy who's dove deep into the subject of deep tech. What indeed is deep tech to start with?
Yeah, that's a nice question to start. In fact, I was going to suggest that because a little bit of history, no one particular person is attributed to in terms of, you know, who coined the name. But I think in the early 2000s, it started becoming popular and also kind of got appropriated by the VC world to describe ventures that relied on deep science and engineering, original invention-based commercialization of products, as against, you know, an application-level software or innovating on some existing well-known technology and things like that. That's a very basic kind of thing. From the VC's perspective, I would say that they look for, and this was given to me by one of the VCs whom I profiled, Karthi Madhasamy, MFP Partners in the US. He looks at deep tech companies in terms of what is the proprietary science and engineering knowledge that they have, which they're commercializing, which can also then act as a competitive edge that someone else cannot easily copy. If you want to separate out companies which are actually building proprietary intellectual property in order to be more of a bona fide deep tech company, there are maybe about 500-550 companies in India. And I would imagine that, and I would wager that even within those 550, there are probably an order of magnitude smaller number of companies which are building very, very original stuff. Yeah, so it's a nascent ecosystem in India. But the reason to get all excited about it is that many experts believe that the ecosystem is on the cusp of kind of going to the next level, where in the coming 3-5 years, we'll see a lot more of this original science-based commercial products beginning to come to the market.
Right. One of the stories out of the 10 odd that you've written caught my attention was that of Cradlewise, which is a dream for parents. It helps babies to go to sleep in far more comforting way. What's the story behind Cradlewise?
They're a very nice example of what at one end can be a serious science and engineering based product, and at the other end is a product that any parent can viscerally recognize with or empathize with, or because anyone who has tried to make their baby sleep, I think, can understand. So it was very interesting. So Cradlewise is a wife and husband team. Radhika was the CEO, and her husband Bharat, I think, is the CTO as well. Studied at Indian Institute of Science. Started out in Bengaluru, although Radhika, I think, is originally from Pune. Bharat is from North Karnataka. The way Radhika told me the story when I interviewed her is that it obviously started with trying to figure out a good sleep solution for their own first child when their daughter was born, and they were not happy with what they found in the market commercially at that time. And they are very sort of problem-solving, brainy techies. And Bharat has some 15-odd patents from a sensor technology that he worked on at Texas Instruments previously. Radhika has previously worked at Qualcomm, working on the Snapdragon chips. So they brought together their know-how. And they started out with some kits from Qualcomm. And Bharat used the sensor that he was familiar with. And they put together a prototype. And today, of course, what they have is a connected smart crib, which has won multiple awards. And the potential for them to build on top of this is huge. It's a non-invasive, contactless, you know, sensor-based technology. And apart from sort of, you know, gently rocking the baby preemptively to put it back to sleep, you can obviously think in terms of, for example, you can start tracking vitals. And in Radhika's own words, you can connect maybe a pediatrician, and you take it to the cloud, and then with all the data, they're also working in terms of a subscription-based sleep coach and whatnot. So very interesting application of knowledge of science and engineering into a product that can be helpful literally to millions of households. Anyone who has a baby that they want to ensure better sleep for, this would be a product of
better sleep for both the baby and the parents.
If the baby is sleeping longer, it's more sleep for the parents. Yeah.
Yes. I remember a friend who was a new father. He would drive 2 hours to work. And so you know that baby on board is something that they put behind the car.
Yeah.
He was contemplating on putting new father on board. So basically warning everybody, to be.
Yes.
And then you have a couple of startups who've done something interesting with robotic arms. One of them by Gokul N.A. and Nikhil Ramaswamy is what I read. They figured out a way to move robotic arms coordinated with the movement of their eyes. It uses vision and intelligence technology. How does that work? And what are some of the applications you think? And what are they up to?
Yeah, what they started out is with a camera module that's guided by computer vision, machine learning, and AI algorithms, and so on. And again, what they've started out with is a module that can guide robotic arms to make them much more versatile. Because in the existing way of doing things, of course, this technology is rapidly changing, but the legacy version is that every time you want to do this robotic arm to do something different, programming it to do that is not a very simple task. Whereas these guys have figured out a combination of these different technologies, vision and all of that, to make a module that kind of mimics the way humans would look at things. You look at something and you can reach your arm out and you can pick up a cup and things like that, right? And sort of an unstructured way. You don't have to worry about what shape it is, where you want to place it. I mean, that is their aim. And I think they've come some way in, getting robotic arms to do some of that. And that's a sort of simple way of explaining it. Now, in the years to come, I would imagine that the application of this technology can go well beyond robotic arms into many other applications, quite possibly into things like assisted driver systems. And currently, this is what they're working on. Yeah.
Would it be right to say that a lot of work is happening in the field of robotics? It has applications on the assembly line, but far more than that. You've got at least three, if I count correctly. One of them being, I think, Unbox Robotics is what I read, that uses swarm intelligence, which is very popularly known for, how ants find their way around building anthills without seemingly not knowing how they're put together, but there is a method to the madness. And then many companies have, airline companies have used it to transport cargo. And then there are many applications of that biological quirk of ants.
Yeah.
So they figured something out there, haven't they? And how have they done that?
Originally, it started out with biological systems, but now it's applied in many, many industrial areas as well. So they make these robots that can vertically stack parcels, and they kind of, like in swarms, they cooperate with each other to get things done very fast. And then they managed to build a software platform to make all these things work together, the robots, which ensures that, they say that they cover something like 95% or 95 percentile, I'm not very sure, of all the parcels in terms of, shape and size and weight that one would typically find in a warehouse. And they've got a fair number of early customers testing out their systems. The other robot companies that you mentioned, one is Orangewood Labs. They are actually working with robotic arms, and they've built some software to make these robotic arms versatile. And also the other innovation that they've done is what they call Robo GPT, where you can try sort of give natural language commands to the robot and it will follow that. And then Ati Motors have made these autonomous mobile robots. Initially, the applications they're focused on are cargo applications in warehouses and factories. But there are many other applications that you could use the same platforms for. The interesting part is, what I learned through talking to entrepreneurs and VCs is that while robotics has been developed for a while, many people seem to agree that the time for robotics has come now. So a lot of experts are expecting that we will see some significant advances in robotics technology in within the next few years.
How do the investors look at the whole thing? Because what you just said will be possible if there is money to back these ideas. And you spoke to many, many VCs. How do they look at this and how's the interest?
I'll answer by recollecting what one of the VCs, Venkat Vallabhaneni at Inflexor, spoke about in the interview that I did. He spoke about how in India, you'll probably find VCs investing closer to commercialization. Whereas if you go to Silicon Valley or Tel Aviv or other hubs like that, you will probably find VC firms willing to invest much earlier in the journey of a startup, where things are a lot more uncertain about whether the science can actually be translated to technology. And it's also the subject of a column by Vinayak Narasimhan. He talks about what VCs can do to win in deep tech investing in India. And we can talk about that more. So in a nutshell, they look at a combination of how close the product is to commercialization and how big the problem is that it will solve. I mean, of course, that part is common to any startup, you could say.
It'll still need some leap of faith in some of the ideas, right? For example, I think Blue Jay Aerospace, where they are trying to build a hydrogen-powered aeroplane with a range of 1,000 kilometers, but now I think they're going with a drone first with 100 kg carrying capacity. Two sets of people. One of them might rubbish it, saying that, hey, it's too far-fetched. The other might think it's an idea whose time has come because of whether it's the way people are ordering stuff at home or with the traffic jams that we have, that might really be the future. That's taking it a little too far. But now VCs have to make a bet on where do I invest and how soon can I exit? Or are these VCs slightly different that they are okay for the money to lie there for a while before something big comes along? So,
yeah, the point about whether these VCs are different is a good one, and that's worth highlighting. I would say that they are different to the extent that they understand that deep tech companies are long gestation ventures. It takes time. The product development from R&D to a commercial product can take several years, and a lot of money needs to be spent upfront on the product development. These VC investors, they understand the problem quite well in terms of what is needed. And if you want to look at sort of a pure deep tech VC in that sense, one of the investors whom I interviewed more recently, whom I couldn't include in the package, is Kiran Mysore at University of Tokyo, Edge Capital. We published his interview as a podcast episode this Friday. UTech has backed companies in India, a few companies in India, that are probably very long gestation. And a very good example is Bugworks in the Center for Cellular and Molecular Platforms in Bangalore, where they're trying to develop a completely original antibiotic for bacteria that has become resistant to existing drugs. It's called, I think, antimicrobial resistance. And it's a very big problem. The World Health Organization and other such institutional sort of finance providers have put up money. I think even the government of India has a program. The US government has a program. Europeans have something, because this is not necessarily of interest to big pharma. Kiran was telling me about it. Bugworks has just partnered WHO to get into sort of the next level of their initial trials and so on. They're still some way away from an actual human, commercially available tablet. But hopefully they'll get there. So that is an example of a really serious deep science company where a VC investor like UTech, and that's in fact in their case, that's their mandate to invest in such companies, where they're willing to invest in and be patient, for years before something commercial happens. So in that sense, I would say VC investors in deep tech companies have to make that leap of faith, probably a little bit more than an investor in a SaaS company or an e-commerce company.
Brilliant. Hari, thank you so much for your time on this podcast. There are so many more stories to do, but I'll leave the readers to grab this copy or read them online or listen to the podcast that you've been recording with all these entrepreneurs in your series? Just remind us what's your series called on the Forbes India podcast, and where can they find those? Where do they subscribe?
Yeah, the series is available within the Tech Conversations podcast on Forbes India, as well as on Spotify and other platforms. It's not on Apple Podcasts, unfortunately, currently. And we're trying to figure that out. Those particular episodes, we've labeled them as Deep Tech India, and they're just conversations with entrepreneurs and VC investors who are contributing to building this ecosystem in the country.
Lovely. Thanks a lot, Hari.
Thank you so much, Abhishek. Fun to talk to you always.
Thank you. All you listeners, you can get this podcast on ForbesIndia.com or any other app that you use to download your podcasts. And to have someone call you for a Forbes India subscription, message Forbes to 51818.